Bring the Environment, Energy, Natural Resources Committee to order. Welcome. We'll start. Representative Bartman, you have House File 1471. I believe I'll move House File 1471. Motion is to be approved and to go to the Commerce Committee. Welcome, Representative Bartman. Good
morning. Thank you, Chair McNamara, and thank you for moving my bill. There is also a DE1 amendment. Hopefully members have the DE1 amendment. I don't know if you want to move the DE1 amendment right now or...
Members, I'd like to move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. Discussion to the DE1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Representative Hortman, your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hopefully you also all have a handout from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and the title across the top is Electronics Recycling Act, Proposed Amendments, April 2011. And if you just look at the shaded areas, they give you a quick summary of what's in the bill. There's four key amendments to our current Electronic Waste Recycling Act. And I think all of you probably know that this has been very successful. It's a product stewardship model where the manufacturers take responsibility for the disposal of products at the end of their life. And in Minnesota, we led the nation. We've been very successful, and we really owe a lot of credit to the retailers and the manufacturers who collected a lot of material. They were very successful. But as the program has matured, it's become clear that there are a couple amendments that are needed. And the first amendment is to change the definition of what's included in the sales. So when we're calculating what percent has to be recycled, that we're accurately putting out the number that's sold. The second amendment reduces the minimum screen size. Right now, I believe it's 9, and we're going to 7. The third amendment would add some restrictions on the use of recycling credits. We're a little bit of a victim of our success in this bill because people collected so much that they have so many credits that they don't really need to collect as much now. And that's kind of a problem. We need there to continue to be an incentive to collect people's used electronics. So the third amendment would change the restrictions on the use of the recycling credits. And then the fourth amendment would just make the previous year's sales data the benchmark for setting the new recycling standard. And I think that's a very, 35,000 foot view. And Garth Hickel is here from the Pollution Control Agency, and he might have a few words to add.
Welcome, Mr. Hickel. Identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Garth Hickel. I'm with the product stewardship team at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and manage the e-waste program. And just to provide some quick background, the agency is required by statute to issue an evaluation report every year on the functioning and progress of the Minnesota Electronic Recycling Act. Some of you may have seen this. We submit it to the legislature each December. And so as part of that review, we did identify six changes that we believed would strengthen the act based on feedback that we got through meetings with key constituents to the act, as well as feedback from particularly local government regarding some of the challenges that they are facing. So we decided to move forward with four of the six recommendations, and that has since been slimmed down to three, as Representative Hortman articulated. So just real briefly, I will just offer some short words about our motivation in terms of some of the specific amendments, as well as then obviously take any questions that you may have. Interest in improving the act is really premised on a couple of key themes. One is ensuring that we do have adequate collection opportunity throughout the state. Right now, there are a few spots, particularly in greater Minnesota, that do not have adequate collection opportunities. I think we're doing quite well in the metropolitan area, and clearly the fact that Best Buy and some other retailers are now stepping forward and offering collection service is extremely important in terms of providing adequate coverage in the metropolitan area. However, in greater Minnesota, we're still seeking coverage in some areas. Number two is that we really wanted to provide as much consistency to the manufacturers as possible in terms of what is happening around the country. You may be aware now that 25 states have moved forward and adopted recycling laws. 24 of those are premised on a producer responsibility model. So we felt hearing from manufacturers as well as recyclers and others who are concerned about the lack of consistency among the state programs that we wanted to step forward to try to address some of those issues. And so we did that with a recommendation regarding the screen size requirement as well as expanding the scope of products that would be obligated under the Act. We're also participating in a effort that's being convened by EPA Region 5 to really look at our harmonization opportunities between Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, and Illinois, the states in our region that do have UA Plus. So we really do take that issue around consistency and harmonization very much to heart. We did receive substantial comment on the report from manufacturers, both from the IT sector as well as from the consumer electronics manufacturers, retailers such as Best Buy, local government, and recyclers. And that really helped shape our decision to move forward with three out of the six recommendations that we ultimately offered. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions that you may have. I know that this is probably new for some of you and may best be handled in a discussion format.
Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Being new to the legislature here, I'm just wondering, on the Act itself, a couple of questions. It looks to me like ultimately the consumer is going to be the one that pays for this recycling. Has there ever been an estimate as how much of the cost is passed on in terms of the cost of the product? And then you mentioned that about 50 other states do not have this recycling 50% or 25 other states. Are they... I guess what I'm wondering is why are they not pursuing that if this is a definite benefit to collection of this electronic devices?
Mr. Hickel or Representative Portman, either one of you want to give a quick little history of where we were at and how long this has been before us and
sure
why we don't see computers as many in the side of the road as we did 5 years ago.
Mr. Hickel.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative, just very quickly on the history.
Very quickly.
Minnesota does have a fairly substantial waste-to-energy infrastructure as opposed to some other states, and so the drive to divert products from the waste stream with toxic and hazardous constituents has been very strong here, with a particular focus on mercury-containing items. And to that end, Hennepin County stepped forward in 1992 and began collecting e-waste to divert that material from going to the waste energy facility in Minneapolis. Several other counties followed, providing that service for constituents. Minnesota's got a very strong recycling culture, and so they obviously felt that that was important. However, there is a substantial cost to local government to be able to do that. Deliberations began during the 2002 legislative session to look at a model whereby the manufacturers would have some financial responsibility for paying for that volume that is collected and recycled. The legislature enacted a disposal ban on cathode ray tube-containing devices, so essentially old televisions, which have anywhere from generally 2 to 7 pounds of lead per television or computer monitor. that really then motivated legislative action during the 2007 session to put this program in place. Regarding the specific cost to consumers, there is no visible fee, if you will, like there is for essentially the program that funds the collection and recycling of lead acid batteries, for instance. California is the only state that actually has a mandated visible fee at point of sale for devices. So it's extremely difficult for me to comment on how manufacturers or retailers may be pricing in the cost of the program. As you referenced, we do have 25 out of the 50 states that are that do have recycling requirements in place right now for waste electronics. All states to varying degrees are looking at various options for improving the collection and recycling. There are all the way from Arkansas to Alaska, Colorado, and in some places. So I suspect Utah was the most recent state that moved forward with the state law. So I suspect that over the next 10 years, we'll probably see the vast majority, if not all states, have laws in place.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Hancock. Thank you. It's good to get a little background. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this could go to either the author or the testifier. Where is industry on this, with this new change? It seems to me like it's going to cost them more. And so I'm just curious as if you've talked to them and where they're at.
Representative Scott, we will hear from the industry if anybody wants. And I don't know if Mr. Hickel or Representative want to speak. Most of them that I've heard from have been neutral on the bill. I'm not aware, though the reality, I would say there's some new people that are brought in on the bill. I can't imagine they support the idea of it, but I guess I can't speak for, there's a few new printer manufacturers, I believe. I don't know, Mr. Hickel or Representative Portman, if you've heard from them specifically.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, we have done some analysis that right now there's about 72, 73, depending on the day, registered manufacturers in Minnesota's program. We anticipate that this will extend the obligation to about another 20 manufacturers or so. That is largely based on our review of the other registration lists in other states.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Scott?
Did you say we are going to hear from somebody today?
We will offer that opportunity, okay. And we'll see. But the ones that I'm aware of have said they're neutral on the bill and may not want to speak, but we certainly will give them an opportunity, and hopefully some, either if they have feelings for or against, will speak up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hickel, you mentioned briefly some of the differences between rural counties and metro counties. Could you flesh that out a little bit more and just explain in more detail how this is going to affect counties in greater Minnesota?
Mr. Hickel, briefly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, by expanding the obligated products, that will then increase the overall obligation that the manufacturers are subject to, so that essentially will increase the volume of material that needs to be collected on an annual basis. Right now, there is an additional half-pound credit for all pounds that are collected outside of the 11-county metropolitan area, and that has helped but has not done a sufficient job in terms of reaching some of the counties, particularly up on the Canadian border or border on North Dakota. So we really feel that taking some steps to be able to expand that collection infrastructure, whether or not Best Buys or other entities that are collecting, is important.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hickel, you and Representative Torkelson, to follow up on his, what are your plans for expanding this into rural Minnesota?
Mr. Hickel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, Right now, we are working with the counties to be able to identify which of the areas are underserved, if you will. And so we have been strongly encouraging them to seek out existing businesses, whether they're haulers, goodwill type charities, or work directly with a hauler such as Waste Management Inc. To provide 1 or 2 day collection services in those counties. So largely that decision as to whether it's an actual county operated program or not obviously resides with the local government, but we do have a grant program as part of this effort that is specifically targeting expanding collection options in greater Minnesota.
And members, we will hear from a representative of Waste Management, at least one county commissioner from the metro area, and we will hear from the chamber yet. So if you think your questions may be helped by one of those testifiers. Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is your plan with this bill today? You know, you're talking about hearing
this
more.
This bill is, I moved the bill to go to the Commerce, and it's the motion is to pass and go to Commerce.
Okay.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hickel, you said there are grants for the counties. Do the grants cover 100% of the cost to the counties?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, that is largely up to the counties to determine in terms of whether they have an existing program with some level of subsidy or end-of-life fees. Obviously, particularly in greater Minnesota, it tends to be that any end-of-life fees do discourage participation. It's much more sensitive to that greater Minnesota than the metropolitan area. So we do encourage no fee events in greater Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add to Representative Fabian's question and Representative Torkelson's question, part of the aim here is to increase the requirements for recycling for the manufacturers. And because right now they can really fill their credits in the metro area, they don't have to reach out to greater Minnesota to fill their credits. And by increasing the number of covered devices, they need to work a little harder to get to the place where they need to be in terms of percent recycling. So there's built-in incentive when you create a need for more recycling to get out of the metro area and go to greater Minnesota, especially with that half-pound bonus that they get for going to greater Minnesota.
Follow-up, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about California having a fee. I'm curious to know how much their fee is. And then also, where I live, we border North Dakota. Does North Dakota have the same law? And is it reasonable to suspect that a computer sold, if they don't, that a computer or something sold in North Dakota is less expensive than one that you would buy, say, in East Grand Forks or Moorhead?
Mr. Hickel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, again, that's probably a question that is best addressed by the manufacturers or retailers in terms of the pricing strategy. Right now, North Dakota does not have a similar law, although several of the jurisdictions in North Dakota have imposed disposal bans on electronic products going into disposal facilities. Regarding California, the actual fee that is placed at the point of sale is $8 for screen sizes that are 4 inches to 15 inches, $16 for 15 inches to 35, and then $25 for 35 inches and larger.
Representative Fabian.
I'm curious to know what's the benefit to the consumer with the bill as it's amended.
Representative Hartman.
Well, Mr. Chair, I can, just speaking for myself, you used to have to pay to get rid of your computers in Minnesota, and now you can get rid of them for free. And a lot of the costs were passed on to us as property taxpayers because counties were doing this job of collecting this electronic waste, and then they were using their property tax, which is what we fund county services with, to pay for those operations. So this is shifting it to a cost that's borne more by the manufacturers and less by local property taxpayers.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got several quick questions. One is the total dollars collected, total dollars dispersed to entities to offset their cost for recycling. Another is what happens if a device is you know, you're making it down to the small screen stuff. So if a device is less than a pound, is that zero or is that rounded up? And I know because I've gone and paid for disposal of old TVs that the counties are collecting money, and you're saying the consumer benefit is, well, you don't have to pay for the disposal. Well, my personal experience does not match that. And then getting on to the recycled materials, where are they going, and who is getting the profits? Because the raw rare earth price point has been going up. China's controlling the market and not allowing and quotizing the rest of the world. Therefore, these materials are rare. So if you're recycling them, I assume that you're gaining those rare materials and that you are that entity is selling them. So if you could enlighten me on those details.
Mr. Hickel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I will take your last question first. Most of the materials are demanufactured in Minnesota or Wisconsin, and then from that point on, they will typically end up in the global commodity market. So circuit boards, for instance, may go to British Columbia or Ontario or Belgium. We do, a lot of the aluminum ends up at a facility down in Mankato. Plastics are likely exported to be reprocessed in China. Lead is, the lead screens are processed at a facility generally in Wisconsin and then moved to a CRT reprocessor in Malaysia or some other location. The agency does not require recyclers to disclose their downstream market. So all what I'm communicating is just simply from anecdotal conversations with them. And similarly, regarding the overall cost, again, the agency is not involved in any of those private transactions between the manufacturers and the recyclers. So I cannot tell you in terms of the overall cost for compliance with the law. And I believe you had one other question that escapes me at the moment.
The first one, Representative Quam.
If it's less than a pound, how much is that charged? But then what is the total amount? You know, we're talking millions of pounds here. What's the total amount of dollars in these fiscal years that you've got figures for that is being paid in? And it was alluded to that the benefit to consumers is that then they don't have to pay a fee. Well, gee, I'm paying a fee, and therefore I'm not seeing that benefit. So where are these dollars going to, and you know, what's the quantity that's dispersed outside you know, the metro?
Mr. Hickel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, again, the agency is not involved in any fee collection for the program beyond the registration fees that cover the agency's costs to ensure program management and compliance and enforcement if necessary. So recyclers are working directly with counties, and the intent is that, obviously, in some places, based on your personal experience, that there are still end-of-life fees being charged. Our assessment is that those end-of-life fees are now lower than they would be if the program was not in place. But again, we're really trying to ensure that there's adequate coverage across the state. The recycling obligation for program year three, which is the most recently concluded program of the year, was about 23 million pounds of material that was sold into Minnesota.
Follow up, Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, are we going to have somebody today that could tell us the total dollars collected out of this and where it's going? Because this testimony seemed to indicate that other than the initial registration fees, all the rest of this dollar, you know, transaction activity, you know, they have no idea. So can we have that information supplied to us? I, I think that's somewhat key to being able to vote on this bill, knowing how much the dollars are and an idea of where they're going, because, you know, that's missing.
Well, Representative Qualm, a lot of this program is done in the private sector. We are going to hear from waste management, one of the recycling, one of the waste haulers. We are going to hear from a county commissioner, and we're going to hear at least from a representative of the chamber and any other private sector folks how they deal with it. They are in the audience and today, and if they have feelings or if you have questions specifically about any one of them, naturally a lot of it is proprietary, and I don't know if they're willing to share it or not, but if you ask a question, maybe they will tell you how much they recycle, how all the fees work, and such like that. But we do intend to hear from those folks, and you're asking good questions. The agency doesn't deal with all of those things. Representative Qualm.
Let me know a person that can tell me just how much money's collected and, you know, where it's going, so I might not recognize them when they come to testify.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hackbart, to this point.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the agency should know, or maybe I have to ask the agency to explain Section 3 of this amendment and how this works. I mean, the registration fee and this antiquated formula that's in here when we originally passed this horrible legislation, the money's going to the agency. And they should be able to have a figure about how much money that they're collecting and where it's going, and how. And I think that represents Quan's question. How much money is the agency bringing in, and how is it dispersed out, and how does it work? I think that's your question, Representative Qualm. And I think
thank you, Representative Hackbart, for that clarification. I misunderstood what Representative Qualm was asking. Mr. Hickel, to Representative Qualm and Representative Hackbart's clarification.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representatives, the agency in program year 4, which is what we're currently in right now, collected $132,000 to fund agency operations. The overall cost to the program, again, is a private transaction between a manufacturer, a recycler, and a collection entity. The agency does not receive any fees on a per pound basis to operate the actual collection and recycling infrastructure.
Thank you. Representative Scott, and then we're going to hear from the different groups that may help some of the clarification.
Thank you, Mr.
Scott.
Chair. And I just, one comment and then a question. First of all, it's not really a free situation because somebody's paying for this, and I believe it would be the manufacturer, and it probably is that cost is probably passed on to the consumer. So I don't think that most people buy that it's a free program. But my next question is, do automobile manufacturers, do they have part of a fee in their structure too? And not to give you an idea of something else, another program to implement, but do they have a fee for the disposal or recycling of every automobile that's sold?
Representative Portman, you'd be a good one to answer that question.
It's
Representative
ironic Portman. That you, I'm sure that maybe that's why you asked the question. No, you know, in the auto industry, the hulk of the vehicle that's left after its useful life is very valuable because of the quantity of metal that's in it. So we don't have this problem of abandoned vehicles on the side of the road because of the metals market. We had a problem with electronic waste because there was so much of it. And you're right, it's absolutely not a free program. The question is, who should pay and where should they pay? Should the people who buy products have that built in the price, or should property taxpayers pay on their property tax? We do pay one way or another. And the other issue there is, can we get the right cheapest disposal? What the program has done is gotten these valuable electronic components into recycling so that their component materials can be reused and remarketed instead of having them in landfills or in incinerators and causing other costs down the line. So you're absolutely, you know, right on that it is not free. But what, you know, and for Representative Qualm's question, I just want to address that real briefly, because if, you know, being new to the legislature, when this bill went through, it was kind of hard for all of us to get our heads around it. But what we do is we set a goal. We say, for example, HP, if you sold 10 pounds in Minnesota last year, you have to recycle 8 pounds. And so we don't care how HP collects 8 pounds to recycle. That's their obligation. And sure, that costs them something. And they put that into the price of their product. How that affects the individual Minnesota consumer is really impossible to say. But the question is, should HP deal with that cost of recycling those 8 pounds, or should Kitson County, and should all the property taxpayers in Kitson County pay for that, or just the people who are buying and using electronics?
And Representative Hortman, just a clarification. It's illegal since 2002, right, Mr. Hickel, to put this stuff in the landfill. Is it before that even?
Chair, it was 2006 that the CRT ban went into place.
Mr. Hickel. Yeah. Members, it's illegal to put this stuff in the waste stream. And that's what we're talking about, and that's what we dealt with in 2007, was how to deal with this, because folks were finding out it was very expensive to recycle them. It was a lot cheaper to drive out in the county road, especially in the rural areas, and just dump it on the side of the road. And the programs now, granted, they're controversial, they're expensive, and it's been a long road here to go down. And I certainly understand where some of you may not support this concept of government being involved in this, and I respect that, and we've had differences along the road on this bill. The other thing, we will work on this. We do really have 3 bills, members, that needed to get out of here by 10 o'clock to go to other committees. But we will spend the time that members want on this. Representative Hackbart.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and you bring up one point, and it was mentioned by the testifiers too, but there's nothing in this act or in this legislation that prohibits local units of government from charging a fee besides having this program in place. And like Representative Quam stated, he's still paying a fee. So it's still possible for local units of government to charge a fee on top of this, just so you know.
Correct. Members, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Kind of in that vein of thinking, and I agree with Representative Hackbart, this is a terrible law, but we have it. And I'm curious as to, has there been a legislative audit done to get at some of these questions, and not only the questions of what are the local units of government with their collection programs doing, what are they receiving from the manufacturers, are they charging, as Representative Hackbart mentioned, additional beyond that? At what point do some of these products maybe have the ability to be sunsetted out of this, where maybe the private market could take over? And Representative Hortman, the value of some of these may come around like they are with automobiles. I know in my district we've got some entrepreneurial people who collect televisions and refrigerators and other things, and they take them apart, and they take the materials, and they do exactly what the waste folks are doing, as Mr. Hickel pointed out. So I'd be curious to your response to some of those questions.
Mr. Hickel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, there has not been a legislative audit. Some of the questions that were specifically posed, the agency does try to track, but again, there's a lot of private transactions that are built into the law, and we do not have access to that information. Regarding the transition of products, obviously that dealing with this product stream is very complicated given the level of technological change. So when we first started talking about it, for instance, there weren't even DVD players that were out in circulation. Now those have even moved on to the next generation. So if we were able to come up with a approach to be able to identify that the end-of-life products really are able to completely pay for their way in terms of the collection and processing, that would be great, and I think we would all benefit from that. Up to this point, unfortunately, very few of those products coming out of the household stream actually do that.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that, Mr. Hickel, so is there any mechanism out there to let us know when that occurs? Could we be subsidizing this with this mandate for these local units of government to do this beyond what is necessary at some point? Do we know at what point, or if that point occurs for some products, will we know what happens?
Mr. Hickel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, that is certainly something that we could try to answer as part of our evaluation report that's due this year. Part of the problem, and that certainly happens on the commercial institutional side of the equation, where the equipment is much newer and has much more value. The problem is that a lot of the stuff that's coming in on the household side is not workable or completely obsolete, like a wooden console television. But in terms of some of those specific products, very new laptops, for instance, that do have some value, we could certainly try to develop an approach to identify those.
Thank you, Mr. Draskowski. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your indulgence here, and I think you've done a good job in trying to explain what this bill is all about and what we're trying to do in Minnesota. And I just, Representative Draskowski, have to take a little exception here. It's not a terrible bill in my mind. It's a good bill. And we've been trying to do this for a long time, and it keeps these things out of our ditches, out of our waters, and it's one of the things we're all concerned about is keeping water clean around here. But I just wanted to touch just briefly on the principles involved here, and it goes back, in my mind, goes back more than 30 years. It's called internalization of costs. So when you go in the store, you go grocery store, wherever, in this case, electronics store, and you buy something, you buy a product, that you know up front what the cost of disposal, if it's in some kind of a case, it's a milk jug, what's the cost of that disposal? You know up front, it's on, you're paying for it already when you go buy that product. So that cost is internalized in the economy itself. You don't have an oh surprise, it's gonna cost you 20, 30, 40 bucks when you go to dispose of that product. So this is all about fairness to the consumer, I believe. And if there are instances where counties are charging you again, well, that's between you and your county commissioners, I'd say. Go out there and talk to them about that. I mean, the way we've been putting out things on counties, they have to keep raising property taxes. Maybe that's part of what they're doing. I don't know. But we're being pretty hard on our local units of government here. So I'd say take it up with your counties. But it's a good bill. Vote for it.
Members, next we're going to hear from Ms. Ketchum from Waste Management. If you could come down, and after her, Commissioner Reinhardt. To the testifiers, just give us a couple of minutes of your testimony. Members, we're going to find out what room we can get in after our time. We have to leave here by a few minutes after 10. We're going to have to go to another room and continue to meet until noon. We have three bills that we have to get through that have to be processed on the floor this afternoon. So those of you that have another committee, you're going to have to let us know where you are as we work through this. We have three bills that need to get processed today. Ms. Ketchum, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Julie Ketchum. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Waste Management. I'm testifying here in support of the e-waste bill, House File 1471. Waste Management is the largest recycler in the state, and we are a private recycler, so I think the questions that were related about costs and revenue and the difference between a private and a county and what's being charged, I think I can help you with some of those answers. Our Eco Park in Minneapolis processes about 250,000 tons of recyclable material a year. We recycle e-waste, lamps, and then just general curbside recyclables. So we're quickly, as the value of different products in the waste stream is increasing, we're quickly diversifying and adding new items to what we're doing over in Minneapolis. We have about 20 different sites statewide, and that material is collected. It's sent to the Twin Cities MRF materials recovery facility, where it's dismantled and then sent on to end markets. Our primary end markets are in the Midwest. We do export a significant amount of mixed plastic. It's difficult to recycle, but Asian end markets do find a use for that. So we have very good idea where our recyclable materials are going and what they end up, where they end up. We've worked with the PCA over the years on this issue since 2004 when we really got into it, and then 2007 the legislation, and we've reviewed the report, and we support all of the changes in the report and in this legislation. In particular, the changes in definition, they're fairly painless. I mean, really, it's adding about 8 million pounds of obligation. Waste management annually, we recycle about 7 million pounds over at our Twin Cities MRF. So, you know, we're one of the three largest recyclers for e-waste. There's two other major ones that are private recyclers in the Twin Cities area. So is this a real impact on the manufacturers? That increase in obligation is pretty minimal in comparison. You know, and there's 20 states or more that Garth mentioned that have e-waste legislation. And so over time, that those increase in costs to the consumer, they're going to be equalized because those manufacturers are working in a lot of states. And actually, you know, there is consideration to do federal legislation. So, you know, the consistency factor that Garth mentioned is very positive in helping us on our end, but also for the manufacturers to know so that they don't have a patchwork of different state legislation. You know, from an operational standpoint, I've asked about the changes in definition, minor adjustment for us to make. So with that, I will conclude my testimony and stand for questions.
Questions for Ms. Ketchum. Thank you. Next, we'll hear from Commissioner Reinhart. Commissioner, if you could keep it short, we'd appreciate it. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Victoria Reinhart, Ramsey County Commissioner. I'm chair of the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board, which is the six metro counties, and I'm also chair of the Association of Minnesota Counties Environment and Natural Resources Committee, and I'm going to be testifying on behalf of both the Coordinating Board and AMC. I should also point out that I am a proud graduate of Hastings High School as well.
Glad to hear that.
Yes. and I will try to go through this relatively quickly. The Coordinating Board and this legislation, we've been working very closely with the legislature for many years on this because this is about product stewardship. This is about the private sector picking up the costs of these materials and passing them on to the users. In some of the cases, when you look at some of the things like appliances, for example, there's an end-of-life fee that I am charged, which is generally going to be higher than if it was actually done through the private sector, which is what the product stewardship model is about. We support and take the lead in the product stewardship, and have taken the lead in the product stewardship approach to electronic recycling, and again are very supportive of these amendments. When we passed this law, you know, it wasn't perfect. And no matter what you do, I guess I don't know that there is such a thing as a perfect law. But especially with the costs that were associated with electronics recycling in Greater Minnesota, even with the additional credit that's given to Greater Minnesota, they still have, there's not enough to cover it. The grants that were talked about are grants that are available to Greater Minnesota counties. They're not available in the metro area. And again, what they have to do is they have to show that they're having, that they need to have some additional assistance. But with the obligations being set too low initially, what ended up happening was it still wasn't enough because the obligation was being met in the metro area. And I should point out that even the costs in the metro area are not fully covered. For example, in Washington County, the total cost in 2010 for the covered electronic devices was $230,000. the amount recovered through this act, or through this legislation, was about $75,000, which means the county had to come up with over, well, about $155,000. Hennepin County in 2010, the total amount was almost $1 million for the covered electronic devices. They had to put in, the county had to put in over $311,000. So this is not something that is being fully recovered even through this system, which is why these amendments are really needed. In Greater Minnesota, the biggest issue is, again, these electronic devices, because people don't want to pay, ending up in the woods someplace, so the or on the sides of roads. And so they feel an obligation. The counties in Greater Minnesota really feel an obligation to offer this. And, yes, it does have a cost associated with it. But they are trying to do their best to bring those costs down. And I know from personal experience, even in the metro area, the cost is much less now than it was before this legislation came into place. We do recycle a lot in Minnesota, and I think you'll hear that from manufacturers as well. I guess finally, I would just like to say that we do, you talked about other states and the legislation that's there. The changes that are in front of you today are consistent with Wisconsin laws, and so we know that it hopefully is working better there, and we would really appreciate your support so that these costs do not end up more and more on local governments. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Commissioner Reinhart? Thank you, Commissioner. Next, Mr. Quillis, I believe you're on the list.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. As the discussion has taken place this morning, we represent, as you have heard, a variety of people that are involved in this issue, whether it be manufacturers, retailers, collectors, or recyclers. And as you can imagine, there are a variety of opinions and concerns about this legislation. But in my conversations with the chair, as well as Representative Hortman, the author of this bill, and the agency, we are willing to continue the discussions that we have been recently having over the last week or so to see if there is some consensus issues that we can move forward on. I cannot promise anything, but we are willing to be a stakeholder and participant in those discussions over the next couple of days. So, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to read that into the record, that we're willing to be participants in this discussion as we go on. You can imagine, like I said, there are a variety of concerns and opinions on this among all our members, so but we'd like to be participating in these discussions as this legislation moves forward.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis and Mr. Chair. Just wondered if you could elaborate on some of those concerns that have been expressed by some of your members.
Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scott, not to put words in anybody's mouths, but you can imagine even in the manufacturing community, in the retailing community, there are differences of opinions on how things go. I know there have been some concerns expressed and how the credits are processed. I know there are some concerns also among some of our members about there is a change in screen size from 9 to 7 inches. We're trying to figure out if that affects a lot of our members too. So those are just two in terms of examples that I can use off the top of my head, but the, you know, dealing with the credits and then the screen size reduction from 9 to 7 inches.
Is there anybody additional comment from the audience, speak for or against the bill? Any of the manufacturers want to testify? I'll renew my motion that Representative Hortman's 1471 pass and be referred to the Commerce Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay?
No.
Aye. Motion carries. Next, we're going to hear House File 1097. It's a bill I have. I believe the agency is here to help with the department.
Thank you.
Members, I'd like to move House File 1097 be referred to pass and go on to government operations. It's a commonly referred to the DNR technical bill, and with me is Mr. Meyer from the DNR to explain the bill.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. This bill was heard and amended in committee previously. We need to bring it back up and refer it to government operations because of the advisory committee language. You will see it in the last sections of the bill, sections 9 and 10. We're extending the Mineral Coordinating Committee. The bill before you is as introduced. It was not engrossed because it was laid on the table. It was also amended in committee. We did remove section 7 and section 8 by amendment. And we also added an amendment that reestablished the Game and Fish Budget Oversight Committee. And Ms. Taylor has that language, I believe, if people aren't familiar with it. It was language that was worked out with the Budget Oversight Committee. They actually drafted it. The BOC was it sunsetted last year. There was language in the Game and Fish Bill that ultimately ended up being vetoed that reestablished that advisory committee. So. Actually, we've streamlined it from about 50 members dealing with all the different staff committees to about 15 approximately. So those are the two changes that were made to the bill, and you will see that once it's engrossed.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Ms. Taylor, would you like to explain the changes, or are we we're good? I think we're good. Are there questions? Representative Kwong.
Mr. Chair, so we do not have before us the materials to be able to read and review this, since this does not reflect what we're voting on.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, you're correct. The changes that did occur on the bill, as I just outlined, sections 7 and 8 were deleted, and we amended the bill with an amendment that reestablished the Budget Oversight Committee for the Game and Fish Fund. I believe Ms. Taylor should have that language, is making copies of that language. The reason you don't have the current reflections is because it was laid on the table. It didn't get processed through the engrossment. This bill, I understand, is going to be the vehicle for the omnibus policy bill in this committee.
Representative McNamara.
You know what, Mr. Chair? I didn't realize that we don't have that in front of the members. Why don't we lay this bill over just temporarily? Well, I believe, Representative Torkelson, we have a bill of yours that we could do, and then bring it back. I was not aware. Representative Kwong raised a good point. We should have that in front of members before they vote, so I'd feel more comfortable. I believe the pages are getting that copied now. I would stand if there's questions to the bill, because we should be sure we'll give people a chance to review that, get it before them, and then we could have a vote on that, and that would all work good from a timing standpoint. We did already vote on it once and pass it. So, but Representative Kwong, do you want to see that? We'll get the pages, make those copies, and then we'll just make the motion to pass it on to GovOps after we get those copies back, if that works for members, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. I do not see any other. Representative Hansen has a question at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative McNamara or Mr. Meyer, I'm looking at Section 5 and 6 on the regional trails and the trail connections. And the shift from 50% non-state cash match going to 25, and I'm just wondering if those two types of, if we're consistent across the board here, or are we still having some trails at 50%, or what? Trying to look at the effective date here on timing as well on things that are in production or in process. Just kind of wanting to know about consistency and implementation
here.
Mr.
Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, the changes in Section 5 and Section 6 reflect an equity issue that was brought forward to us by our staff dealing with the legacy grants that we have for parks and trails. There is a requirement for 25%. These two programs are still at 50%. Therefore, people would go to the cheapest grant program first, and then come to this one. We wanted to make sure they were all on the same level, provided for equity, and people, it would direct people to the appropriate grant program that way, rather than to a 25% match first and a 50% match. This would be effective for grant rounds coming into the future after the bill would be enacted, so for next fiscal year.
Mr. Chair, just to confirm then everything would be consistent if this bill passes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, yes, it would all be 25% match.
Thank you. Other questions to the bill before we lay it over? Seeing none, we'll lay 1097 over for consideration later.
Members, we're moving along here, so we may, maybe it was the thought of having to shuffle to another room, and Representative Torkelson is going to do his House File 908 now. Representative Torkelson, you'd like that to also go to GovOps. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 908 to be passed and moved on to GovOps.
Representative Torkelson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an agency bill dealing with the Wetlands Conservation Act. I have a representative here from Bowser who will explain the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dave Wyrens with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And what I'll do is probably a brief,
Representative Torkelson, if I'm not mistaken, you have a DE.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
DE4 amendment that you'd like to move. Why don't we do that, and then he can get the bill in the shape that
Thank
the author
you,
would
Chair.
Like.
Thank Chair. I would like to move the DE4 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like.
Discussion to the DE4. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Amendments adopted. Representative Torkelson, to your amended bill.
Thank you. I would, again, refer to the representative from Bowser to explain the bill as amended.
Let's try it again. Identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Wyrens with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Members of the committee, this is a package of changes to the Wetland Conservation Act that mainly deal with administrative changes. There are some substantive ones that will affect the application of the law, but a lot of what we're proposing here through the House File 908 are changes intended to simplify and streamline the administration of the program while still ensuring the desired results of protecting the wetlands. That is the primary purpose of the Wetland Conservation Act. I'll roll through each section briefly because they aren't all directed towards a common purpose, and having some understanding of each section seems appropriate here. Section 1 modifies the definition of local government unit, and what this does is it gives some new authority to the Department of Natural Resources to approve wetland banking projects as they relate to mining projects that they regulate under permits to mine. What this change will in fact do is it will give some additional authority to DNR. It will increase some flexibility for the mining companies and how they provide for wetland replacement for their projects. And it will ensure that local governments have some input into the regulatory process for permits to mine. The second section deals with electronic transmission, and the Wetland Conservation Act was enacted in 1991, predating much of the electronic communication that's so prevalent today. And what we are simply doing is modernizing, allowing email to be used as a means to provide notices of various actions under the law. You will see this coming up in numerous places in the bill as we're trying to modernize the statute to allow more flexibility in communication. And that's, in fact, what Section 3 is doing, is simply allowing for the electronic transmission, you know, via email as part of a notice of a contractor form. Section 4 is a change that warrants a little bit of discussion on regarding wetland replacement siting. What we are doing here is modifying and really simplifying how wetland replacement siting can occur under the law. It eliminates some of the complexity that distinguishes between project-specific wetland replacement and wetland banking as it applies. And what it's doing also is it's being clear that it can, in fact, allow replacement to move from more wetland-rich areas to areas that have lost more of their wetlands historically over the course of the state's history. The one section I draw your attention to on page 3 of the DE4 amendment starting at lines 3.13, is a provision that we are proposing to put in that would give the board some flexibility to establish an alternative wetland replacement priority siting order. And the purpose of this is where there is data that indicates that replacement opportunities are limited, is they would use that data to establish an alternative, and it will be done through a public process as is outlined in this section. As we move to section five is the first change on page four, again, just to allow for electronic transmission of notices, modernizing the statute. The second change on 5.1 to 5.4, we are deleting this language, but we are reinstating it later on, and I'll discuss that change there. We're talking about local appeals of local government decisions. Section 6 makes some changes to, again, how we do some notifications. It streamlines and simplifies the process for providing notices of applications. Again, these decisions are public processes run by local governments, and this is a way to, again, simplify how we let the folks involved in the decision-making process, as well as interested individuals, to be aware of these projects. Section 7, again, is of that same vein, electronic transmission and a simplification of process, fairly minor change. Section 8 deals with local appeals. This is a provision under section 5 that was deleted, and we are restoring it here. What we are doing is establishing an additional 15 days time for local governments to make decisions on these appeals of staff decisions. The concern we have here from many of our local governments who administer the program is the fact that 30 days is not enough time to receive an appeal, to gather information, to schedule a meeting of the governing body, and to make a decision on the appeal, all within the confines of Minnesota Statutes 15.99 that governs the decision-making process for Wetland Conservation Act actions. So we're adding what amounts to 15 additional days to give local governments more time to make a decision on appeal of a staff decision. Section 9 deals with appeals to the Board of Water and Soil Resources. There are a process for virtually every decision by a local government to be appealed to the Board of Water and Soil Resources for further consideration. And we're modifying the statutory provision that governs how we manage the appeals, again, to provide some modernization, but also to address some concerns brought to our attention by the Attorney General's Office as it relates to allowing appeal of all decision types, and as well as in terms of what some of the decision standards are, trying to, again, modernize and make the process work well. Section 10. This deals with fee authority that has been granted to the Board of Water and Soil Resources to manage the wetland banking program. And what that is, it's a process whereby individuals will restore wetlands, and then they will, you know, bank the credits. It's like a banking account, and that they can sell those credits to individuals who need credits to offset their impacts. What we're providing for is flexibility in how we impose these fees to allow for certain kinds of wetland banks to be established. This in particular relates to that very first provision where when the Department of Natural Resources is overseeing wetland banks regarding permits to mine, we want the ability to have a lower fee schedule because our oversight is less because the DNR is part of that process. So we want the flexibility to have lower fees where it's warranted. Section 11, this establishes a clear provision in the statute regarding how appeals of restoration or replacement orders are in fact conducted. What we're doing here is allowing for a separate process because these are from other appeals, because these are not decisions of local units of government. These are enforcement orders involving the Department of Natural Resources conservation officers most typically. And we want to make sure that there's a process that's not the same because there's a different record of the information, and therefore the process should in fact be somewhat different. And we are allowing for that within the context of Section 11. Section 12 is a modification of statute made back in 2007, excuse me. And what we're doing here is we are allowing increased flexibility in the use of preserving wetlands to generate the required wetland replacement for regulated projects. The restriction on having be only on publicly owned land really makes this provision unusable by and large in the parts of the state that may in fact be able to use this. We want to have some flexibility that where there are quality wetlands, that this can in fact be an option to offset impacts that are regulated under the Wetland Conservation Act. And then Section 13, again, just kind of closes the loop on our electronic transmission language. Just to make it clear is that if somebody wants to receive their notices via U.S. mail, as they have in the past, they can continue to do so. And this provides that flexibility. Last thing I'd say, Mr. Chair, is there are ongoing discussions on several of these provisions within this bill, and we at the board anticipate working further with interest to make sure the bill is in order as it moves through the process.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just really want to kind of reiterate what was just said, that as you can see, the fact that this is a DE4 reflects that we've been working on this bill for quite some time to try and get it into the shape that that can be supported, and there are some potential amendments that may come up, but we're not going to amend the bill today, but we are going to hear from some other testifiers regarding some of the issues that are somewhat controversial.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, just curious, you know, we hear a lot about all the different governing bodies that oversee water and those sorts of things, and I'm just wondering what this bill does to eliminate any duplication between agencies, if you can point out anything in particular.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott.
Mr. Warens.
The legislation does not increase or reduce the number of decision-making bodies in the Wetland Conservation Act area.
Representative Scott, follow-up.
I was getting more to, like, some of the policy. I understand that, but were there any changes that you made in this bill that would have eliminated any duplication that you know of?
Mr. Warens.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, the one change that is relevant is in that very first section where we are giving the DNR some additional authority. What this, in fact, does do is it gives DNR new authority to oversee these wetland banking projects when they're related to permits to mine. And what that, in fact, does do is it will take that away from local government. So that, in my view, that does streamline the process where that the replacement and the project are all within DNR, whereas otherwise the local government would have done the banking project, the DNR would have done the permit to mine piece. So this would have some benefit to streamlining and the coordinating those angles of it.
And just
Representative Scott.
I might thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Warens, with all the changes to the electronic transmission and so forth, do you anticipate much cost savings in that, or is it negligible or
Mr. Warens,
significant?
Sorry.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, there should be some cost savings by having, you know, less paper, less postage, that kind of a thing. It's probably not going to be very significant on a LGU by LGU basis, though.
Thank you.
Representative Huang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, with this language and that, could there be some improved language to handle the impact of wetlands lost by flood-induced activities? You know, one example is the Shady Lake lost their dam. It's determined that it can't be replaced. So now you have, you know, the lake bed is still mainly wetland, but upstream you're losing some oxbow and some other places that, you know, backwater areas that do not or will not sustain being a wetland. So how do you handle that accounting, and what is the impact to you know, the local, you know, government that has that land?
Mr. Warens.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, based upon your description, the way those circumstances could in fact apply is, you know, where due to natural causes an area has become drained effectively, is what it sounds like, is there be an opportunity for, you know, an individual to restore those wetlands and gain the wetland credit to offset impacts that are otherwise required to be replaced? It seems there would likely be an opportunity to use those in those cases.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're implying that, you know, even due to natural causes, once something's been wet and defined a wetland, that even nature's not allowed to change it back, that you would have to have somebody make it back into and be restored in order to be compliant?
Mr. Wierin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, the way the Wetland Conservation Act operates is that when an individual wants to use wetland areas to offset an impact that's regulated, there's required oversight under the law, is that there has to be an action to actually capture that restoration activity.
Representative Quam.
I guess I'm confused. I'm saying, you know, what if nobody is interested or has the funds or desire to restore that wetland? Is there any impact legally?
Mr. Wierin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, I guess my observation would be is that if that land that was a wetland is drained due to natural causes, there is no regulatory oversight of that. It happens. There's no requirement for a local government to go back and to restore it because that was a natural event. That wasn't a human cause directly. So there'd be no obligation for anybody to offset those impacts in some other fashion.
Representative Canute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I more of a question about process because my briefs and things don't have the delete everything amendment, so I appreciated the thorough walkthrough. That was helpful. But it looks like this amendment was drafted last night at 5:22, and I was in committee from 6:30 to 11:30 last night, so I didn't have a chance to look online yesterday evening. And I know there's a 24-hour rule, and it's difficult this time of year, but I just want to, especially with these kind of more complex delete everything amendments, just ask if we could... I understand the 24-hour rule sometimes needs to be adjusted, but I just came in this morning, was kind of looking at this and not quite sure what was in it and what was different. So I appreciate the walkthrough, but just wanted to make a note of that, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Representative Canute. It was emailed out last night, but it was after supper sometime when it was emailed out. It was after we were done. So, as you know, when we're in this week, it's going to be very fluid, and we're going to try and pay attention and be cognizant of that, and that's why I gave the agency the liberty to spend a lot of time walking through the bill. So if we have questions, it's the same with Representative Quam asking the question on 1097. We're going to try and accommodate people and be flexible. It looked like we were maybe going to need to move to another room this morning yet, and now, just again, as the audience should know, it looks like that may not happen. And if we don't have to move to another room, we will just recess and come back this evening. So I know there's folks in the audience on the other bills. At this point in time, I don't think we'll be taking up anything other than these three bills with two of them are still in the middle of. There are some other testifiers that we should bring down on this bill. Ms. Fernette from the Builders Association, I believe you're on the list to testify. If you could keep it short, we will have to allow just a few minutes for 1097 to also move prior to our 10 o'clock time. Ms. Fernette, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Torkelson, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak on the bill. We have been working with the Board of Water and Soil Resources on this bill since its inception in the beginning of the year. We appreciate everything that they've done and move forward to address some of our concerns. We still have one concern. It's on the local appeals process. We're working through the issue with them, and we're hoping that we'll be able to resolve it shortly or over time. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Fernette. And to Representative Canute's point, at this point, if I'm not mistaken, Representative Torkelson, you're going to go to GovOps with this bill, but I think it would be good for this bill to come back here after that. So, Representative Canute, why don't we intend that by the end of the week it will be back here potentially again. Representative Hackbart.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As long as you're talking about the tracking of this bill and where it's going, where else does this bill have to go? There's a fee here. Does it have to go to taxes? Does it have to go to Ways and Means and those kinds of things too?
Representative Hackbart, I believe this bill will end up going to Ways and Means. They are not part of the deadline. Representative Torkelson, do you know as far as the route to taxes?
I do not know, Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative Hackbart, we'll have to look at that, and if there's a problem,
at least box taxes, see if they want to see this thing there, because I had a little fee in a bill, and it was a $4 fee, and taxes wanted it, so.
It's a great point. Thanks, Representative Hackbart, for bringing it up, so we'll have to see if we can accommodate that schedule or not. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually had a couple questions for Bowser, so.
Okay.
We may be going a little
bit. Mr. Wierens, you could come back down. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Wierens, I seem to remember a few years ago a long-term kind of multi-stakeholder process for revising WACA. It involved lots of meetings and a couple years, I think, to make the recommendations. And could you maybe contrast that process with the development of this bill?
Mr. Wierens.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, I believe what you're referring to is back starting in 2007, the board amended the rule that governs the Wetland Conservation Act. It was a process that took really roughly 2 years from start to finish. A big part of that process was the way the rulemaking is really required to be done is to maximize the public opportunity to be part of the rulemaking development process. We did establish a large group of individuals representing the broad range of interest groups who care about the wetland conservation, have been engaged with us over the years, and we met on a frequent basis in developing, going through rule issues from start to finish. The one thing that I think is important, a characterization of that rule process, is we rewrote the rule from start to finish. It was not a rule amendment, it was a rule rewrite. You may not know it's the same rule just by looking at it at face value. So that really warranted really sort of an over-the-top public input approach, because we're doing a lot of things, moving parts around, and people get concerned about that if they look in one place and it's gone and moved somewhere else. The process in developing this particular bill, in fact, some of the changes that are here came out of that rulemaking process. There were changes that individuals would like to see in the rule that we could not make, a statute would not, in fact, allow us to. So we are here to bring those changes forward. We did, in fact, bring this bill forward, much of it forward, last year. It did not make it through the process, or bring many of the same issues back. There are some new issues that have come forward. We have, in fact, over the past month or so, had numerous meetings with a range of the interests that have been involved with them. They're principally involved some mining issues. We've had a number of conversations with environmental interests and with Ms. Frenette and some of her interests on the development side as well, too, in dealing with their issues in particular. So we've been very open to meeting and working on issues with anybody who is concerned about our changes, and working to find a resolution that meets our goals, meets the goals of our local governments, as well as stays true to the purpose of the program as provided in the state policy.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, did the agency meet with any folks in the House or Senate? I'd like to say the leads did. Did you meet with Representative Wagenius on this particular bill, or the delete all?
Mr. Wierens.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, I cannot answer who all has been discussed in the legislature with this legislation.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, if I could maybe drill down on one particular section.
Go ahead. Representative Hansen.
Mr. Ware, in Section 12, the easements, and it looks like a relatively significant change here. It talks about providing wetland replacement or mitigation credits now to private entities within the 80% area, and it talks about being held by the board. Would the UPM Kimini forest easement be eligible under this provision to be receive wetland credits?
Mr. Wierens.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, the answer is no. That would not be eligible under this provision. The rule has an important provision in it that we will continue going forward with. There must be, the term is demonstrable threat. There must be some threat that wetland may be negatively affected for preservation to be allowable. if there is an existing conservation easement, that land would not be under any threat of being damaged, being harmed.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, but if the law change goes in and you established a new conservation easement, let's say a new forest easement where the land is still owned by a private entity, would they then be eligible for wetland replacement credits?
Mr. Wierens.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, obviously the first question would be is what are the terms of that other forestry-related easement? What are the terms of that? What activities are in fact allowed? We'd have to take a look at that to determine is there a threat to those wetlands within that easement area. Without knowing information, it's really not possible to give a clear yes or no answer. But certainly having any protective easement is going to lessen the risk and make it arguably less likely to be eligible.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Wierens, let's move away from a DNR easement to a Bowser easement. Let's say there's a rim easement that's in the 80% area, and the landowner is a private landowner that could be paid for the rim easement. Would they also then be eligible for banking credits under this provision?
Mr. Wierens.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, the answer is no. The rim easements do not allow wetland impacts under the terms of the easement. Therefore, there would be no threat if not be eligible.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any easements separate from rim easements, let's say easements held by a nonprofit that's transferring it to the state where wetland credits could be obtained during that transitional period?
Mr. Wierens.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, again, that'd be dependent upon the terms of the easement and the transfer and what activities are or not allowed within it. Again, it gets back to the matter of are those wetlands in any potential threat of being impacted as provided under the Wetland Conservation Act? And the other thing to keep in mind as well, too, is that the amount of credit that is allowed under this is very, very low. The range of the rule is it starts at 8 acres for 1 acre of credit, so it's a very low amount of credit. It's a very land-intensive way of generating replacement credit. So it's less likely to be very attractive to a lot of individuals. But in the cases that you describe, all Bowser easements do not allow wetland impacts, therefore they would never be eligible under this. Other easements, we have to take a look at the terms and the reality of that. Just because a landowner says they might do something to property doesn't mean they in fact will. And you have to have some assessment of that as part of the determination of is it eligible or not for this provision.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, it appears then that this could open the door to the public paying for a certain bundle of sticks and then the private entity still being able to achieve a credit, even though the public is paying for a bundle of sticks. It would depend, we would be trusting the negotiation on the easement process here, and I have a little concern here on the opening of the door. We didn't get a complete yes or no on some of the easements compared to some of the Bowser easements, so I have some concerns relating to Section 12.
Representative Wagenius.
Hey, Mr. Chair. I'm going to look at Section 4, which is a major change. And first, I want to just touch base about the science of wetland replacement, because the science may have changed and I may not be up to date. But it's my understanding that science has not yet been able to produce a replacement wetland that is in functioning as well as nature originally provided. Am I right about that, or is science taken much bigger strides than I realized?
Mr. Wierens.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, I give an answer of probably a couple parts, I suppose, on that. One is that under the Wetland Conservation Act, when it comes to generating replacement wetlands, the preferred option, the way the law lays it out, is through restoring a previously drained wetland. So you're restoring the hydrology, you're reestablishing the native plant species so that you are having a wetland that is going to be you know, if not identical, very close to what naturally would have been there if never been impacted in the first place. The other part of the answer is that if a creation is happening where you're establishing a wetland where one has never existed before, you're digging a hole in the ground, you're allowing the water to come in, you're planting the plants, I think in that second case, certainly the science I'm familiar with is that those do not function at the same level as a natural wetland. And under the program, the amount of credit those wetlands get is less than you receive if you restore what previously had been a naturally occurring wetland.
Representative Wiggini.
Well, I am looking at lines 2.24, 2.25, 2.26, and essentially what I read here is impacted wetlands in a 50 to 80% area can be replaced any place in the state. Am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Wierens.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gaines said that is not correct. The way those lines read of 2.24 through 2.27 is that the way that language works is it allows wetlands to be placed from wetland-rich down to places that have fewer impacted areas up in northeast, the middle stretch of the 50-80 counties, which is a band of counties, some part of the state there, that 50-80% range, and then the less than 50% of that south in the Red River Valley. What this would allow are impacts from the middle band, the 50-80, to stay in their zone or go to the less than 50, but you can't go to the more than 80.
Representative
Gaines. Northeast part of the state.
Oh, basically, thank you. They can go most of the state except for the northern part of the state. So we do agree that that is a significant change. Okay, when I look at that language and then look at the alternatives, and this is on 3.13, I do not see quality criteria. We look at wetlands to benefit our groundwater, both in quantity and quality. We look at them for habitat. But I don't see anything now that we're changing the siting process. I don't see anything that helps us with the benefits of wetlands or the quality of wetlands or the outcomes of what we expect from wetlands. I guess I'm not seeing the outcomes language that I believe we should have. Am I correct about that?
Mr. Wierens.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gaines, I'd maybe first just respond to your first point about that language on 2.24 through 2.27. I think the thing to keep in mind is that language does allow at the high level of impacts replaced in lower wetland-rich areas. However, I draw your attention to the lines that are not changed of 2.28 through 2.30. It does force the examination of looking close to the impact site before you move out to move further away. So you can't just jump from your backyard where you have an impact to, you know, three counties away. That's not, in fact, the way the process works. You have to go through that. And, in fact, if you jump a major watershed, then you are allowed to do that. You are correct in your assessment, but then you have a higher replacement ratio. It jumps up from the painful area of the state from 1 to 1.5 to 1, so it's a 50% increase, or if you're in another part of the state, it goes from 2 to 1 to 2.5 to 1. So you're getting, you are allowed to do that if approved by the LGU, but you have to pay for it. It's not a free move across the state line. So just to be aware of how we're applying that, because we are adhering to the principle of the wetland is very site-specific in its benefits. If you move the wetland, you transfer those benefits. So one of the goals of the program is to keep the impacts, the replacement as close to the impact as possible within the confines of how the program and the law operate. To your other point on page 3, that paragraph B of 3.13 versus 3.28, this provision speaks to the where replaced wetlands are located. It does not modify the existing requirements on the quality of the wetlands and the standards that must be met when a wetland is being restored or created to offset an impact. Those standards remain very high, and there are monitoring protocols that go into that as well, too. So it is those standards remain very high. and we work very closely with our local governments, with our own staff, with our own monitoring program to make sure that those replacement wetlands are of a high standard. We acknowledge the fact that an impact is a wetland gone forever most of the time, and therefore the replacement wetlands need to be of a high quality as well.
Representative Wagenius, can you pull your mic down, too, please, when you talk? Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
Okay. Then you're asking me to assume that all your processes right now are giving us quality wetlands. But before you said that, so then should I assume that all replacements that you are doing right now are in former wetlands and none in dig it out and try to replace a wetland?
Mr. Wierens.
Mr. Chair and Representative Guineas, the answer is no. Not all replacement wetlands are restorations. However, it is a choice at the front end when the applicant is proposing the impact on one, on their property, and they're deciding how they want to comply with that. Generally speaking, I believe the ratio for creations, which are not preferred options, but I believe the credit is what. If you do a creation, you get 75%. So you need a quarter more land for starters to get that same replacement area. There is a penalty for going that particular route if you think of it that way. We try and create incentives for doing the best environmentally and the most sustainable long-term action under the program. And through how we allow the credits, we provide those incentives to landowners. But it's their choice at the end of the day to decide how they want to go.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Okay, which brings me back to the point. If you're moving out of your watershed, out of your minor watershed, out of the same watershed, out of the same county, into a wetland service area, I mean, which is essentially what's be happening here. If you're going that route, do you allow folks then to... or do you require folks to go into a former wetland, or do you say it's your choice, you can go into a former wetland or you can dig out?
Mr. Wierens.
Mr. Chair and Representative Guineas, the program does not in fact require it. However, there is an important incentive built in the program that's important, again, to be aware of, is the preferred option under the current program is to use wetland banking to offset impacts. And what wetland banking are is a individual landowner typically restores larger areas on their property, and then they sell the wetland credits. It's a business proposition for them, making value off of their restored opportunity on their land. It's not very economical to do creations at a large scale. They're more expensive as well as getting a lower credit. So there are built-in disincentives to creations. It just as a matter of economics, even if you don't consider the environmental considerations that are important here as well. The program would not prohibit creations, but again, there are built-in disincentives to going that particular route. And the other thing that comes into play here, and this is kind of where I think there's a conflict in the law, and we've heard this from our local governments, is on the one hand, the law does in fact require looking as close as possible to the impact site for replacement. Well, sometimes all you can do is dig out a corner of your property to restore a wetland, and some LGUs in fact have required that to be done because the law does say look on site first before you move on. And sometimes that only option is to do a creation. So we're trying to find a balancing point between trying to maintain those local hydrologic and vegetative benefits of wetlands within our area, with the perspective that that's not all. Doing a creation on site is not always going to be the best long-term environmental solution. So you have to have a flexible program that acknowledges these competing interests while trying to ensure that, on whole, the state's environment is being well respected and protected.
Representative Wagenius.
Yeah, just one last question, but a comment. I just feel very strongly that the outcomes are missing in this whole proposal. When we're changing, this would be a good opportunity to look at what kind of outcomes we're actually getting. We're process-oriented and not outcomes-oriented, and it would be a good time if you're going to change this to go to an outcomes orientation. But I want to go back to a follow-up on Representative Hansen's questions on Section 12, because I'm not quite sure I understand that. But basically, my question would be, if we are going to allow private where we're changing and saying it's not a state or a local unit of government, would it be possible for somebody to purchase land, say, using our legacy funds, have an easement, and then create wetlands or and get a double, kind of double dip that way?
Mr. Wierens.
Mr. Chair and Representative Guinness, the circumstance you describe is, I guess I have a hard time seeing how that could play out in a real world setting, because what you're talking about is if you're going to do a creation, I wouldn't use this provision. I would use the other part that gives credit under the creation portion of the rule, because you get more credit. That's the route that I would go.
Representative Guinness.
No, thank you. My question is a little bit different.
Okay.
If you are getting money from the legacy program to buy an easement, and you buy an easement in an area that, say, was a former wetland, and you decide to replace a wetland there as a bank, can you then use that for credits under this law? In other words, double dipping, getting money from the legacy program and getting money as a wetland bank credit.
Mr. Wierens.
Is it possible?
Mr. Chair and Representative Guinness, being familiar with the purposes of the legacy funding, I don't see how that's possible as if you're, how could there be a threat to a wetland if you're trying to protect habitat, which is the primary purpose of those funds? It seems there's a big mismatch. There could be no threat if legacy funds are involved.
Representative Guinness.
Thank you. I think this one has to be rethought, because if you're just buying a piece of grassland and it had a former wetland on it, but it was not a wetland right now, and you chose to put a wetland there, I can't see why you could not get wetland credits for it. I mean, legally, I can't see why not.
Comment, Mr. Warren.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Guinness, is that the situation that you just described there, again, doesn't fit this language, at least in my observation of it. Because if you have a parcel that's what's being restored as part of the legacy project, because, in fact, for the RIM funds that we've had received, we use funds to restore wetlands as part of those projects. We take the easement, we use funds to restore the landscape to a natural condition. Those lands are not eligible for wetland credit under this program. I mean, that's a clear example of what you're referring to. They're not eligible. It's
Representative Tarkle.
It doesn't fit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe we're through. Are you through with questions and ready to move the bill?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question for Mr. Wierens back on the 50 to 80. So essentially, just to clarify what that is it allows net loss in the 50 to 80 if you have the net gain in the under 50.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, the way the program, it would allow impacts to replace outside of the 50 to 80 zone in a less than 50, but at a higher ratio. So the state overall would gain more wetlands, even though you are in fact, I think, correct that there could then be a case-by-case reduction within the 50-80% zone.
Representative Torkelson, you want to renew your motion?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay?
No.
Okay. Motion carries. Members, I'd like to bring back 1097. You now have the A1 amendment before you. We had adopted it on the previous meeting.
All those in favor of 1097 say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendments are the bill's passed. Members, we're going to recess. We're going to come back this afternoon. For those of you in the audience, why don't you watch check the emails and the website. We'll try and update the order that we're going to do the bills this evening. We'll be coming back, I believe it's at 6 o'clock, Mr. Harris, at 6 o'clock tonight in room 300 North. So we're going to be cozy again. And if there's folks that have time constraints this evening, if you could stay in the room and let Ms. Rudolph know your issues with times, we would appreciate that. Thank you, members. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, I noticed last night or yesterday afternoon on the calendar, when you look on the website, the House website, that it doesn't update during the day. So, for example, our committee on the main calendar at 8:15, but it didn't have the time or locations, or nor did any other committees that moved around afterwards. And I know that people were having difficulty finding, so maybe it's getting updated on the committee page, but the calendar, there's a larger question on that calendar recycling, so it knows where people, where the committees are in the afternoon.
Thank you, Representative Hansen, for that update as we try and move through a very busy week. Thank you, members. We're in recess.
Yes.